Welcome back to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Americans are struggling with addiction, from opioids to social media. To neurobiologists, they all look similar, and a growing body of research suggests that mindfulness can be part of the solution. Judson Brewer is director of research at the Center for Mindfulness at UMass Medical School and author of The Craving Mind, From Cigarettes to Smartphones to Love, Why We Get Hooked and How We Can Break Bad Habits. The book is now out in paperback and just as timely as it was a year ago, so we're revisiting our original conversation with Brewer. We began with the evolutionary roots of addiction and what makes some people more susceptible than others.
Certainly there are genetic factors that might predispose some of us to get more addicted more easily to cigarettes or other drugs. So I think of human nature, and that this taps into a natural reward-based learning process. Some of us learn better than others, and some of us learn certain things more easily than others, whether it's using cigarettes or using smartphones.
Let's take one that's really been in the news a lot. You've actually specialized in addiction psychiatry and done a lot of work on opioid addiction. Mm-hmm. Would you say that that kind of substance abuse addiction is the same as smoking or technology addictions or simply kind of bad habits? Are they all fundamentally the same thing at some level?
At a deep level, they're fundamentally the same thing. So this learning system may have been set up from an evolutionary standpoint to help us remember where food is. That's important.
Definitely important to know where to get food. But how does that lead to addictive behavior?
Yeah. So if we think of – so let's break it down. The simplest version of this is trigger behavior reward. So if we see some food and we eat it and we get a signal to our brain that says, oh, calories, you know, this is good for survival – then we lay down this learning process that says, oh, remember where the food is and you can come back here and get some more. If we fast forward to modern day where food is plentiful, we don't necessarily need this all the time because there's a McDonald's on every corner. Yet this process is still at play and still at play quite a bit. So our brains start co-opting this and they say, you know, well, why don't you use this to help with stress? So when you're stressed out, why don't you eat a cupcake to feel better? And we start doing that. Or why don't you smoke a cigarette, et cetera. So this same process, this basic process is at play when we start to get co-opted to, you know, smoke cigarettes, cupcakes, use heroin, et cetera.
Do you really think the things that we've started to call addictions, at least in slang, things like technology addiction, smartphone addiction, social media addiction, what have you, are those really addictive problems? Are they really problems, or are we just using that shorthand?
So if we look at texting, for example, it's now been shown to be as dangerous as drunk driving. So if texting while driving is killing as many people as drunk driving, I would consider that a problem. There was a study that showed that with the rollout of smartphones, that emergency room visits for young children under the age of 5 increased proportionally. I would consider that a problem.
You give one example in the book of some young women at the Louvre in Paris that instead of maybe looking at the paintings, they are instead using a selfie stick and taking pictures of themselves, even though they had other people with them who could have taken the picture. What do you see as problematic in that situation?
I think that's funny because Time magazine named the selfie stick one of its top 25 inventions of the year back in 2014. To me, it's a sign of the apocalypse.
Well, I can't say that I just can't seem to get into the idea of carrying this enormous thing so that I can take a picture of myself. But I'm not sure if I would have said sign of the apocalypse.
Well, and maybe that's a bit strong. But the idea here is, and there's now really nice research to back this up, that it's rewarding to talk about ourselves, to do things self-related. And I won't go into all the details, but that when you scan somebody's brain when they're self-disclosing, they activate the same reward-based learning processes as heroin, alcohol, cocaine, cigarettes.
Is the addiction there really the technology, or you said it's the self-disclosing? It's this act of perhaps thinking about yourself and also projecting your self-image? Are we just addicted to ourselves, or are we actually addicted to the technology?
I think the technology enables the addiction. So there are elements of technology. For example, we can talk about ourselves. We can gossip, which also is juicy. We can distract ourselves whenever we want. So if we're feeling bored and at a stoplight, we can pull up our phone and check Facebook, for example, as compared to like just sitting at the stoplight for 30 seconds. So there are a lot of elements where technology enables this, including intermittent reinforcement, where we never know when we're going to get that next text or that next tweet or that next like on Facebook. So it keeps us coming back for more.
It's that suspense and the FOMO, the fear of missing out, that we always want to know when's that next hit coming.
That's part of it, yes.
I can see how the evolutionary origins of looking for food and getting a reward when you've found the food, kind of, I can see how that would work. Where does boredom come into that?
If you think of boredom from an evolutionary perspective, so food tastes good, you know, we eat more of it, that's positive reinforcement, right? Also, when things are unpleasant, we want them to go away. So that's negative reinforcement. It's the same learning pathway. Does boredom feel pleasant or unpleasant?
I guess it feels unpleasant to most of us.
Yeah, I would say in general, if somebody had to pick, because there's a restless quality to it, like, oh, I'm bored, you know, like I need to find something to do. Our brains are looking for something that's more interesting. That's where, you know, if you think of boredom, we're looking for something more exciting to do. So that boredom piece actually stimulates us and says, do something, you know, make me feel good, entertain me.
And that's what we can get out of our technology.
Yes.
There's an addiction that you talk about in the book that might be surprising, and it's addiction to love. I mean, of course, we're all looking for love for the love of our life. How is that a problem?
So I think there, and I'll speak partly from my own experience, I found that it was really, when I was in college, the excitement of romance was like being on a cocaine binge, right? I can get hits of excitement when I thought about my girlfriend, you know, when's the next time I'm going to see her? When's the next time I'm going to get a kiss? You know, I can even fantasize into the future. Oh, and we're going to live happily ever after. You know, I can already plan to our retirement before I'm even married. So there can be a quality of romance in particular, especially the early stage in romance, this infatuation stage, that it's as if we're on drugs.
That's a process, though, that for the vast majority of us, it wears off over time. It's not something that lasts forever. So does that really fit the same mold as these other addictions and the kind of pathological addiction that we've been talking about?
I think like many things, so with certain, let's say, behavioral things that we get excited about, we might get excited about a video game and then it wears off over time. Some people continue playing that video game and become more and more obsessed with it. And I think there can be, for the majority of us, thankfully, you know, the excitement of the romance kind of gives way to more stable, you know, love, let's say. Yet some people can become obsessed with relationships where, you know, they're constantly like worrying whether their partner is going to do something or they're, you know, so there can be a quality of being caught up in that relationship that persists. Whereas for the majority of the population, that moves into a more stable relationship.
In case you're just joining us, I'm talking with neurobiologist Judson Brewer about his newest book, The Craving Mind, From Cigarettes to Smartphones to Love, Why We Get Hooked and How We Can Break Bad Habits. So especially if we're talking about something as omnipresent as romantic relationships or smartphones at this point, it's really important to distinguish between this is something most of us do and maybe it's a habit versus this is a problematic addiction. And you actually have this 11-point quiz, which we're going to post on our website so folks can take it for themselves. But what are some of the questions that we should all be asking ourselves if we're wondering if our behaviors are still in the healthy realm or if they're moving into the unhealthy realm?
Right. And this checklist comes from the Diagnostic Statistics Manual 5, so the DSM-5, which is kind of the psychiatric Bible for taking symptoms and trying to determine whether somebody falls into a certain category. There certainly it's not perfect, but it's a way that we can, you know, start to work clinically. So, for example, having a craving for, you know, so whether it's our cell phone or our significant other or, you know, getting likes on Facebook? You know, are we, do we have a craving for whatever it is? Are we consistently thinking about using whatever X is? Are we withdrawing from or going through withdrawal if we are not, you know, able to use whatever? Is it affecting our relationships, whether it's family, whether it's social, whether it's work obligations? So those are some examples where we can start to see, we can just go through this checklist for ourselves. Is this affecting my life in a way that's not helpful?
Mindfulness is a tool that you talk about being a way to try to break addiction. So how can mindfulness, which has become this buzzword everywhere, how can it help with addictive behaviors?
You know, I've even moved away from the word mindfulness a little bit because it's a concept. And like you're saying, it's become this buzzword and it can mean many things for many different people. If we bring it to the experiential level, we can think of this in terms of awareness. So if we bring awareness to what's happening, and if those positive and negative reinforcement loops, so if there's something pleasant and we want to hold on to it and we have this urge to make that continue, or we have this unpleasantness and we have this urge to make that go away, that push and pull with the pleasant and unpleasant is an unsteady, you know, has a restless driving quality to it. That's what addiction is. It's driven, you know, driven behavior. So here, if we can bring awareness to the process itself, it helps us step out and not be driven by it. You know, we talk about having the ability to respond to a situation rather than habitually react to it. Does that make sense?
It sounds a lot like another version of kind of mindfulness training. If you're angry, you know, the stop and take three deep breaths before you actually respond. Recognize that you're angry and that you don't have to act on that anger in an impulsive way. So kind of the same thing. Recognize that you're craving and that you don't have to act on that craving in an impulsive way.
Absolutely. And I would add one piece to that. The other thing we can do is as we're acting impulsively, we can pay attention to what we get from it, because this is all reward-based learning. So it's based on rewards. Well, if our brain has learned a reward to be a certain thing and we don't go back and check to say, is that really rewarding? We're just going to keep doing it habitually. But if we check back in and say, is that really that rewarding for me? It might help us change the behavior. I'll give you an example. With our smoking program, we encourage people to smoke and we say, just go ahead and smoke, but pay attention as you do. And they get this wide-eyed wonder, like, where did I not notice this before? Because they start to realize that their cigarettes don't taste that good.
But there's still got to be some reward there that was driving the cravings and the addiction in the first place. What's the reward for not doing it?
What's the reward for not smoking?
Yeah, what's the reward, you know, if you notice that Facebook is a problem and you always want likes, what's the reward if you don't go on Facebook and you don't get likes?
Yeah. So the first thing that we can – I love the Facebook example. The first thing we can look at is, what's it actually feel like when I get likes? You know, it's this restless, excited quality that wears off quickly. And then we're like, where's my next like? I need another like. So we can ask ourselves, how good is that compared to, you know, the peace and joy that comes from like not being addicted to Facebook?
You're talking about mindfulness in the context or this awareness in the context of trying to break bad habits or addictive behaviors. Can it be used to prevent addictive behaviors?
That's a great question. I think it absolutely can be, because the more we – so let's say if we're changing an old habit from habitually reacting on autopilot to, you know, whenever some stressful situation comes up, we become more curious about it. So curiosity, curious awareness – is really what mindfulness is about. Curiosity in itself feels pretty good, right? Curiosity as compared to this craving that I have to do something. So if we can move into that realm of curiosity and start to train that as our new habit, I don't know anybody that has gotten harmed from paying attention more to something, right? So this might be a good habit to develop. As we develop it, we can start to see when we might be pulled into the direction of new habits or new addictions that might pull us off base or get us into these loops that are more restless and driven than as compared to just, you know, just being with whatever is, if that makes sense.
So how could people, if they're interested in trying this kind of awareness or mindfulness, how could people get started in their daily lives?
There are many ways that people can get started. So obviously there are many books that are written about the nuts and bolts of, you know, how to start practicing mindfulness. There's a great one that's free actually on the web called Mindfulness in Plain English. That's a good starter manual. I read that one 3 times, but there are tons and tons of books out there. There are also courses that people can take here at the Center for Mindfulness. You know, this is where mindfulness-based stress reduction was first birthed about 35 years ago. And there are MBSR courses all over the world now that people can take. And now in the modern technology, people are starting to develop apps to help train mindfulness.
I was going to ask you about the irony of mindfulness-based apps.
Yeah. So there are a lot of people are getting into the fray, you know, just giving basic, you know, meditation practices. We've taken a more evidence-based approach where we take pain points. Specifically, you know, if somebody is smoking, you know, we developed an app called Craving to Quit that helps them start to overcome smoking. Even if people are stress or emotional eating, we use that as a pain point. So if somebody has pain, they're motivated to try something. So we can bake in all of the science and all of the experience that we have with the mindfulness trainings that we've developed right into that. That app's called Eat Right Now. So there are, you know, there are basic, you know, sit down and take a breath meditation apps, and there are more, you know, ones that are more mechanistically based, like the Craving to Quit and Eat Right Now.
Judson Brewer is director of research at the Center for Mindfulness at UMass Medical School and author of The Craving Mind, From Cigarettes to Smartphones to Love, Why We Get Hooked, and How We Can Break Bad Habits. That book is now out in paperback. And that's our show. Until next week, this is Living Lab Radio. In the meantime, you can connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab Radio is produced by WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio in Boston. It's produced by me, Elsa Partan, and Heather Goldstone is executive producer. Funding for Living Lab Radio comes from the Candida Fund, investing in transformative leaders and ideas. Theme music by Stellwagen Symphonette.